Welcome back to Deep Thoughts, ladies and gentlemen. I'm coming to you from the lounge here, smoking my Placentia hexagonal cigar, which I actually have to claim that the one thing I got wrong about the moon missions was that the Saturn V launch pads were hexagonal. They absolutely are not, unless they built different ones that aren't photographed. And so the Hicks mid-60s carpet in The Shining bears no semblance to anything in reality for a launch pad. So it's been a while since we've done anything about the moon specifically. The main thing we're going to get into today, in addition to reviewing a bunch of logic, because there's a problem with understanding things like the moon hoax, is the recent confession regarding where it was filmed and when it was filmed. The moon missions are very interesting because you get people who are uninformed, that maybe they have suspicions, maybe they don't, maybe they're really staunch, you know, fanboys in NASA. And what they end up doing is getting educated about the facts, the smoking guns. It all makes sense to them. Maybe they're watching a video, maybe they're having a conversation with one of you, and they're on board. They're totally on board. And then time passes, and the repetition that we went is the only thing they're hearing, you know? And they're not strong-minded people, strong-willed people. They don't typically think for themselves. The exercise of watching a video or listening to you was one of the first times they maybe manufactured a single neuron in their brain. And I'm actually being very serious about that. And so they end up going back into the coma that is the boatload of lies. Now, what's interesting is if you've ever been following this and you're frustrated at times with the idea that this is ever going to get revealed, are we ever going to say, look, we didn't go, you know, there's a reason why we never went back. There's a reason why no other country's been there, besides lies about rovers. But I mean, a person walking on the moon, it's just, where's the footage, right? 50 plus years. And it's the only thing man hasn't been able to replicate, including the agency that supposedly stepped on the moon 6 times with 12 guys, with the computing power of God. We don't even have devices in this world with that little of computing power. Your first computerized chips inside of an engine in the 80s have hundreds of orders of processing power more than any claim of rote memory systems inside the lunar lander or the service modules or any of the launch mechanisms on the ground. But we know that there's stuff that's actually being revealed day to day in the 21st century, the second decade, actually the third decade technically of the 21st century, that is so horrific in its truth that society is probably going to find that the most difficult thing. And it has to do with humans being moved around the world and abused. That's the number one most important thing that's going on right now in world history, is the reveal of that information. Who's doing it? Who has done it? Who actually was the number one person to have done it? Both those that are past already and those that are still alive. And then we have to decide what to do with them. There's some recent movements of indictments that will actually, hopefully, result in evidence being brought into court that will start revealing some of the mechanisms to select our politicians. And that'll just be this thread that will get pulled out of the sweater. And with that, the card that holds up the whole house of cards will come down. And it's going to cause some unrest between friends and family members. Again, there's some people out there that have thrown down so hard that we went to the moon that if the government literally said we didn't go, it was all a hoax, and this is exactly how we did it, those people will still hang on because they have no intellectual option. Some people will most likely take their own lives. Not many, but there will be someone who's alive today that if it's ever revealed in an official manner, they will take their own lives, because they will feel betrayed to that level and they will have thrown down with their family members and friends, and they lack the moral aptitude to say they're sorry or just simply say, well, you can understand where I was coming from. I was defending my country. I trusted my country, and I should have been able to trust my country and a space agency paid for by my country. And they're right. And we should say that to them. We shouldn't be jerks. We should say, man, I understand. You believed what you were told because you come from an era where you should have been able to believe what you were told, which is odd because the 60s of all decades in the 20th century was the most blood-laden intelligence agency murdering era in American history, if not world history. I don't know all the foreign leaders that have ever been liquidated, but usually they keep sort of a slower pace to these kind of things. But, you know, JFK, RFK, MLK, Malcolm X, some other shenanigans where people got injured real badly were running against Richard Nixon. There's been a confession that Bart Sibrel was lucky enough to get a videotape of. And it's the same sort of videotape that's about, the Kubrick false confession. Now, I have personally taken the Kubrick confession and given bits and pieces of it to one of his daughters. And I said, look, is this your dad? I mean, I don't mean to be disrespecting your father, disrespecting you. I just need to hear it from your voice. Is this your father? And the reply came back, no, and I'll tell you why. And it was really because of the physical makeup of the face. And she said, just look at some of the last 15 years of my father's face. If nothing else, she said he had very dark bags, dark rings around his eyes and very pronounced bags under his eyes, which were just a genetic trait. And she said, look, you know, this guy doesn't have any of that. And how do you get rid of that? You know? And I believe that. Then I talked to Bart Sibrel and he said, look, they mentioned the fact that I was punched in the face, which didn't happen until 2003, at least that anybody knew until Astronauts Gone Wild was released. And so that happened 4 years after Stanley's passing. I mentioned this before, but I mentioned everything I'm going to probably talk about in this particular episode, but this is all in that themed episode where you came for this content. I've said it before, but I do believe it's possible that the audio about the Sibrel punch could have been added to the video. I can't remember what the actor actually said in return. I haven't seen that video in a long time, but it, Bart is a very astute man, and he knows all about editing and trickery and stuff, and would probably have thrown a bone to the video if he thought that they could have gotten a copy of it, realized that they were sunk, make an edit that kills it, and put it out. I mean, if that was the case, it was the most brilliant idea ever. Nothing changes the fact that the geometry and placement of his features on his face were as near to identical as the real photographs that I was able to get, including mole patterns on the left cheek. I mean, wow. Someone put some serious effort into this thing if it's a fake. I don't understand the rationale for putting all the money in to create a fake, honestly, because they said it was for that movie that came out around the same time. But then the movie was like, we didn't make this. We would have promoted it if it was the case. It also seemed like the movie was published at a time to stir up and dilute anyone looking up that subject matter, because when you go into Google, when a movie comes out, they buy all the keywords, and if you're searching for something legit, you'll start getting the movie instead of legit research, and they use that as an excuse in a historical way, right? But nonetheless, this was a fake event. As I've told you in previous episodes, especially 520, which is one of my favorite episodes I've ever done on this topic, the NASA program was all about creating intercontinental ballistic missiles, or ICBMs. Wernher von Braun showed the world what a V-2 rocket could do. Remember, the V-1 is a buzz bomb. It's more like a plane with a little pulse engine in it. Utterly brilliant. But that's not what they wanted to do. That's more of drone technology, to be honest. The V-2 was formidable. A big, giant phallus full of conventional explosives, TNT or otherwise, using time gyroscopes. So when it launched into the air, the gyroscopes were on timers to tip the rocket to get to London, finally. and wreak havoc. The notion that they could actually fire a rocket several thousand miles away was a pipe dream at the time, so that it required a tremendous amount of research. Rockets with, say, solid propellant, like toys that we fire, you know, when we're in high school or middle school or whatever, they have a different principle of balance and propulsion. Once you start putting liquid in a tank and lighting that on fire, and you've got to drop it out of engines at a particular exact pace, any bend in the tube, if one of those engines is critical. The Russians were absolutely ahead of us by, I would say, at least two decades, because engines that were found in a Siberian warehouse that Russia had mothballed in 1972-73 were then captured. Well, they asked permission to buy them. Bought a couple of them, brought them over, and they were more powerful than NASA's most powerful rocket engine in 1995. So the idea is, if they're more powerful than the rockets of 1995, they may have been technically 50 years ahead of the United States. They're more powerful because they were able to use unspent fuel back into the engine and spend it like a turbo engine does in a theoretical way. And they couldn't get there because they couldn't create a rocket with enough thrust to get it there, to escape the Earth's gravitational force. What's interesting about this is that when someone comes in from zero, they either don't care about the moon missions or they care about the moon missions and they think that we went, and you're trying to teach them the opposite. The real challenge there is that they go from zero to potentially believing. Let's say you can get them to that summit where they've seen enough smoking guns. They're like, oh, well, wow, I've never seen that before. I never even thought about it. But yeah, it makes complete sense. And by the way, I'm an expert in that, and I never even put it together because I just believe. And they're good for a little while. They talk to you, they watched a video, whatever the case might be. But then they go back into the wild, and the repetition online, an anniversary happens in July, and they get it from Facebook, they get it from whatever social media, it's on the news, whatever, and they're like, oh, yeah, we went. Yeah, totally, we went. And they just unravel the knowledge that they got. Because which one feels better? Remember what Tony Robbins told you about the brain in the 1990s? He said, look, if you could just map negativity to the proper things and positivity to the proper things, which addictions get that inverted, right? Then you get rid of everything out of your life automatically. Your brain will automatically reconstruct your entire life to be on the good side of good and the bad side of bad. So you understand, and you know, you want to change your life, it just automatically happens. But the trick is to remap it properly so you're passionate about the things that you want. And you hate and loathe the things that you'd want out of your life. And that principle plays a big factor in whether or not someone can retain knowledge that is sort of forbidden or against the grain of their brainwashing. We don't hear much about NASA in general. And what's fascinating about that is that you have an organization that spends more than $65 billion a day to stay afloat. And we're okay with that. We're okay with that. We just give them money. Yeah, they do neat things. And, you know, they do hire some of the most academic left brain geniuses out there. And I define genius not by someone who's creative, but by someone who can retain and repeat information at incredible levels. They're not academically stupid people. They do, on occasion, in a particular division, hire some extremely creative people as well. What I find to be the most creative people involved with NASA's operations, aka their extension organization called Jet Propulsion Laboratory, formerly Jack Parsons Laboratory. Make sure you watch that video on deepthoughtsradio.com. It's the intelligence agencies around those organizations that cover up for their lies. That's where I find the most consistently brilliant people involved with aerospace. The amount of weird excuses they've come up with is just tremendous. But the other one, after years and years of having discussions with people about the subject matter that I will sort of warn you about if you're trying to pass the information along, and if you understand this, you'll get very creative with it, is that what is a smoking gun for you will have barely any effect on another human being sometimes. And the thing that you think is the most ridiculous, oh, well, of course, that you minimize something, let's just say, will be the utter smoking gun for someone else. For Bart Sibrel, the thing that he mentions the most about on-moon evidence, when they're basically saying, here's all the photographs and movies of us supposedly on the moon, are the shadows. For him, that is 100%, because he's a director in his life. Those shadows are his smoking gun of smoking guns. For you, it might be something different. But just understand that when you talk to people, you know, it just depends on the sort of number of years an individual has been following this particular subject matter as to the density that could be applied to the smoking gun conversation. What do I mean by density? If I said the shadows on the surface of the moon converge because there is a multiple light sources lighting up the stage, which was in the warehouse, right? The two hangars that were built together in New Mexico. That doesn't take a lot of strength in the mind to understand, because you can walk outside and see telephone poles and trees and houses and objects in your yard or in a park especially, or driving down a street. You can see they're all parallel because the sun is a single source 93 million miles away, supposedly. And so that is a low-hanging fruit for someone who's new. For me, what is brilliant and easy to understand is that the maneuvers of dropping off the lunar lander from the service module, when they crawl through the head, and you know, first that lunar lander comes from behind the service module, comes all the way around, and then rotates 360 and connects to the front. Wow, right? All these things that you couldn't practice until the day you had to do it. You can't practice anywhere in the universe except for in the middle of space. That for me is, wow, that is such a cluster of odds against that we would get it right every single time that it's just impossible to believe. Beyond that, let's just say that Shadows on the Moon is a 101 course. What I just mentioned, all the maneuvers of dropping off the lunar module and having it come back up and rendezvous with the service module, you know, the lunar module is coming straight up from the moon, and here comes the service module, which is not and cannot be in a geocentric orbit with the moon. You know, rendezvousing with that thing, little thrusters and stuff, moving it around in the vacuum of space, interacting with nothing but having 100% control. Let's say that's 201. And then the very idea that rockets work in space is like the super advanced PhD level of evidence that someone's going to have to really grasp the mathematics and physics of aerospace to understand a vacuum is a nothing. Multiplying anything times a nothing is nothing. You can talk to yourself, you can move yourself around, but you still can't subtract your initial velocity in space. You're never going to slow down. You can move your parts around in the box that you're in, but you can't slow that package down. You just can't. So what has NASA been doing? Well, we don't have any more space shuttle. You have ISS stuff, but even that's calmed down. And the Orion missions seem to be concluded, figuring out how to put flesh through the Van Allen belts. But I want you to be hip to something that I see all the time, which is when NASA is about to say anything publicly. They just had their little anniversary, but boy, it just came and went, didn't it? When NASA is about to say anything publicly, there's an algorithm I believe that they use, which is the following. They're about to lie because they're about to talk. And so they know that people like us exist who know that they're full of crap for virtually everything that they say. And so they have to spin up the disinformation campaign that's going to actually talk about what they're about to suggest that they have accomplished, or some status update or something, right? And then they know we're going to push back. They know that we are the many and they are the few. the ratio is actually astronomically against. 100 million people know that they're full of crap, at least in this planet. And there may be, what, 100, maybe 1,000 people they hire to say something. And of course, they do put it on the airwaves to try to catalyze and augment it up, right? So one becomes 100, becomes 1,000, becomes 100,000. But we're still stronger by a large margin because they're not inviting any dialogue with us. They're just issuing blank statements that are what they say they did. The more that you're hip to this algorithm, the funny thing is that you'll see it. You'll see them say something. You'll see videos like these come online right after they say it. They get crushed. And now they don't draw any attention to themselves and create web pages anymore like they did in 2000, where they tried to do a line-by-line itemized list of, they said it was a hoax because of this, and here's our excuse of why it's not a hoax. And then people that need to hug their teddy bear at night and believe that this is true, that's all they need. They just need to be reassured that you're a liar. Okay. But then there's like little tidbits that come out. Did anybody see the video of the new Sphere in Las Vegas? Sphere is a gigantic ball in Las Vegas that has a theater inside, but it also has a gigantic grid of LEDs on the outside. Now, what's interesting is the new Tron ride in China and Florida, Disneyland, is said to have the most LEDs in any structure in the world, but I think the Sphere just blew it away. Now, what's totally unrelated to this is that I worked with my buddy and I from 2009 and up, and we have diagrams of what the Sphere is on the web since 2010, and no one was talking about it, and no one understood it, and we're the people that kept showing it and showing it and showing it, saying, we're going to make an LED dome theater. And so someone finally did. I'm very happy. But when you go inside this thing, it's a gigantic portion of the Sphere, which is an LED screen. And it is capable of convincing you you're in different worlds because it is so photoreal. Remember, I told you, as soon as you see an LED theater, especially the 3D stuff that we came up with, it'll blow your mind. I mean, it's going to change the way you experience fiction. But we kept saying that the ISS is most likely using an LED wall to create the Earth and no stars, of course. And then, you know, using tangible assets in front of the screen, like space station stuff, in water, potentially in water all the time, maybe water only some of the time, and putting together this fabrication. It could also be not an LED screen and be substituted in later. The curvature of the Earth is always wrong in these things. But sometimes the evidence of what we have been suggesting for decades finally comes out. There was an event in 2001 in September. And around 2005, a video came out called Loose Change. And it was suggested in that movie that the calls from passengers to their family members was instigated using AI technology to simulate a voice that sounded like the person who was calling home. And that was just poo-pooed and dismissed, and that doesn't exist and could never exist, and now you can download software that does it. Now you can use a website that does it. Hollywood's already done it several times now. But no one's doing the follow-up and saying, well, now, don't you guys remember when you said I was an idiot because I suggested this was the way that this happened because I saw this movie that told me how it worked? And, you know, if you just have a mild understanding of AI, big machine learning, it's not that big of a deal. I mean, it's definitely some brilliant freaking software, but I trust that those people exist who could find the spectrum of a voice and find the inflections and the normal speed and cadence. All those videos of the fake Obama talking, unbelievable. People talking into a script. And was it Elon Musk did it? He talked and he was Obama. He was other people. He's showing you what's possible. He's not your hero, by the way. So this confession. The confession comes through this gentleman who was the son of the head of security of the moon hoax, Apollo 11. He was head of security, so he revealed to his son a few things. Number one, how they built the set and how it was arranged. Two warehouses that are slash aka hangars built together on a Air Force base in New Mexico. They bring in a lot of soil and rocks to create the terrain of the moon. And then to make it gray, they covered it up with cement dust. Brilliant idea. The lunar module was out front under a tarp in pieces, and they brought it in and assembled it and then craned it onto the set. Obviously, they craned also the lunar car onto the set with no tracks in the first shots. That thing was a remote control vehicle anyway. He said he had the list of people that were allowed into the building. The three most notable names was LBJ, the president, Lyndon B. Johnson, who showed up for the first day of shooting around noon and then never showed up again. Henry Kissinger was on the list. I don't know that he showed up. And the other one was Wernher von Braun. I don't believe they said he showed up either. But they greenlit a bunch of construction at this Air Force base so that when the trucks were coming in and out with all kinds of stuff, they were lost in the minutiae of other construction at the base. Another brilliant idea. I mean, the power of the government to create a hoax is really just second to none. I mean, we Americans, I swear to God, we create the most creative evil people out there, it seems. And then after it's over, said and done, and this was supposed to be in June, first week of, or really the second week of June 1968, starting in June 8th, they tore it all down, got rid of all the evidence, gone, poof, history. Then this Aikens guy, he had an employee, an associate, who felt ashamed because he was probably a God-fearing man. And he indicated to the Aikens gentleman that he was going to blow the whistle on the whole thing. And so the Aikens guy killed him. No authority from anybody. He just did it on the spot. Poof. Then he was most likely commended for his, you know, keeping the wraps on this thing, license to kill sort of thing. Held on to that secret until he dies on his deathbed and gives it to his son. And he said, the reason why I'm telling you this is because I killed a man. And I'm utterly ashamed and I'm about to meet my maker. So I need to tell somebody. Then the son lives a pretty decent life and gets to his 70s at least. And he's sick. And so he decides to make a video. And he gives it to Sabrell, and who sent him a camera and everything, and said, look, just don't release this until after I'm dead. I don't really understand that too much, because if there's a family you're trying to protect, well, the family's still behind, you know, but that's the theory. Shortly after giving this tape to Sibrel, they said that his house was raided and any paperwork or evidence about what his father told him was destroyed or confiscated or both. And then he passes away and Bart just released it this year. The value for me personally was sort of when and where was sort of a trivia question. It wasn't terribly important to me, but it was interesting. So June of 68, I could believe that. It means they had a lot of months, to analyze the material they created. It does baffle me that they made any mistakes whatsoever having that much time to think about it. I just don't think it would be that expensive to go back and do some, at least Hasselblad retakes of some gigantic mistakes. But they also needed months and months to cut together the negatives because they didn't have Photoshop back in the day. They didn't have a digital system. I mean, the Pixel was, I think, 2 years old by the time we landed on the moon. Ivan Sutherland having created that. Maybe a year old. But they've got to cut these negatives up. They use people that counterfeited money to microscopically cut out all these little things that they were going to do. And they continued that process, I believe, until 72. There was no software to help at all. I could probably theorize it, but it wasn't there. But truth be told, the thing that really is of value to me personally was that I couldn't quite understand exactly how they faked the surface to look gray. And to use cement, dust is perfect. Perfect, perfect, perfect. Ample supply. You could layer it very, very deep. It would get on the astronaut's clothing exactly the way that you see it. Anyone who's ever worked with cement. I mean, I grew up in a little town in Kansas, which has the Ash Grove Cement Company. I say cement and cement. I think cement's the proper way to say it because the E makes the other E long. But 8 miles away is the Monarch Cement Company, which is even bigger. And then about 12 miles away is another Iola, Kansas, which is another one. There's three of them, three gigantic ones. I grew up with the rupture of the ground when they would blast the quarry to get the soot that becomes that stuff. So that for me was the big, wow, that's cool that it would know. And building two hangars side by side so you could bust out the wall in between, paint it flat black inside. Very cool. It still kills me, to segue back to the ISS, that anyone would suggest that modern-day digital cameras can't capture stars in space, can't capture the Milky Way. You can't mute the Milky Way unless you have a bed of light from a city. But you go out in the wilderness, a lake or something, and that thing is unbelievably loud in the sky. And to have you out there in space, on a spacewalk, an ISS, sure, theoretically speaking, if you have an old 1995 camcorder and you point it at the, you know, where half the frame is Earth and the other half would be space, I could understand that a lot of that darkness would be wiped out by the brightness of the Earth. But as soon as you just fan it to the right and get all stars, remember, it's a space station without a window that points towards space. The only window points towards Earth. What the hell was the point in building it? Why don't you call it the International Earth Viewing Station? Another sign it is not what it says it is. Is there a piece of trash up there? Maybe. I don't know. Is it possible to put something in lower orbit that's big, that flies at a differential speed that would make you think you're looking at a space station? I think the answer is probably yes. I think one of the things that we sort of subconsciously measure when we talk about the facts of the fact that we didn't go to the moon is we look at the hubris of the government and those agencies to tell a lie. And we judge it. We say, well, were they at the level of telling that level of a lie? Because that's a big one, right? And when you look at what's at stake, I think the answer is yes. They had already killed a president, his brother, and two black leaders prior to this event. In fact, the year before, they killed MLK and RFK. The year before, man. You think they got a problem lying about a space mission? Ooh, I don't think so, man. Did they ever think they were going to go? I don't think so. I think you have people that don't know what you're talking about in terms of the technicality of getting there, that are lower at NASA. It could just be a 1 degree, 2 degrees below a true astrophysicist that's looking at this thing going, what, are you kidding me? But just 2 degrees below, you probably have a guy going, wait, man, they say we're going. That's great. You know, and it's just be no problem. And because of that, the old argument that you'd have to have thousands and thousands of people in on it is all horse crap. Absolutely not. This amazing Saturn V rocket launched, and it didn't blow up one time. That is an accomplishment that is very, very real that we can celebrate as human beings, even though it's probably the budding platform to create intercontinental ballistic missiles, which are definitely the devil's play toys, right? I mean, I think that we could say right now the derivative of that technology has turned into Tomahawk missiles, of which hundreds and hundreds and hundreds have been fired, and hundreds of thousands of people have been killed by them. Several million have been killed by sort of the repercussions of them. Probably not directly responsible for hundreds of thousands of deaths, but enabling other sorties and other troops to be able to carry out their missions to kill that number of people, right? But those Saturn V rockets were gorgeous, took off, and probably got into low orbit. There's still a debate in my head as to whether or not we got into low orbit. All the tuna can spinning of Buzz Aldrin, that we know that could be a vomit rocket. So if you want to ask me, hey man, do you think we really got into low orbit? It's like, well, because all of the measurements of the Saturn V's total weight and the thrust of a Rocketdyne engine isn't truly disclosed, and all the information's been hidden and said to be destroyed or lost, no one can really vouch for the conclusive, yeah, I think we could. No, we probably didn't. We just don't know, you know. I think it's just, once you see the Saturn V take off, and you definitely can look at the telescopic movies of it, and it's hauling ass, man. I mean, we've seen SpaceX stuff haul ass in space. I mean, at least up the space above us, right? It is up there quite a ways. And if you can drop out of a plane for technically a couple minutes, if you're at one of the highest levels of skydiving, to have a vehicle being thrown around the world, you know, if you can just miss falling down to the Earth, then you're going to fall around the Earth with the force of ether pushing down on you. So, you know, you could get a few orbits, I think. It makes sense to me. But the real question we haven't really addressed towards the beginning of this story is, you know, when did they get to a point where they could greenlight something? Remember, they said, we want to get to the moon, put a man on there, and get him home safely within the decade. Now, technically speaking, I think they had till 71 to pull that off and still claim success. I mean, you know, honestly, if you ever do it ever, it's a success. So who gives a shit if it's 10 years, right? But the pivotal moment is the Saturn V being able to take off and not explode. That's it. Once you've got that, you've got an out of sight, out of mind narrative where as soon as it's out of sight, you could tell whatever narrative you want. Oh, they went to Mars. They went to the moon. They went to the sun surface and had hot dogs, you know. But that's the key moment. And I would love to know when they figured that out. They did have their claim of Apollo 8 going to the moon, circling. Apollo 9 went into orbit. Apollo 10 supposedly went to the moon and orbited, came home. And so what they're really trying to figure out is all of the contingencies of the hoax, putting the gel on the window to expose probably what's not exactly Earth in a fisheye lens, like I've said in the past, but recent analysis of that shot that Bart Sibrel was sent and leaked, he has changed his mind, and I happen to agree with him because it always bothered me to make it much sense that Earth is completely in the window of the capsule in orbit, and all it has to have is light on the other side. And then the weird gel on the window. And that for me is more of a confirmation they were in orbit, because if this was completely a Hollywood set, you wouldn't have to have held the obstruction up to the window. It could have been all done on the outside of the vehicle with someone just holding it out like a movie prop. But since you don't have anyone on the outside, you have to do it inside because you are actually in low orbit. So they launched this rocket in July of 69. And it's supposed to be traveling a few days to the moon and then going through this huge landing sequence, of which all of it is completely out of sight, out of mind. I mean, if you see footage today of all those maneuvers that are supposedly happening between the service module and the lunar module, that's all on film on those vehicles, and it has to be brought home and developed before you're going to see anything. We see everything real time. For instance, the day in September 2001, the first supposed impact of an aerial vehicle into a giant skyscraper wasn't released, I believe, for like 17 days or something. It was several days after. Today, they make you feel like you saw it that day and you didn't. You saw it many days later. So a lot of time to craft what you ended up thinking you saw. So all the public sees is the launch, which is phenomenal. And again, man could feel extremely happy about that one event, to be honest. Then you have at NASA headquarters, I believe in Houston, you've got them projecting on a wall the footage of, you know, Neil Armstrong coming down the ladder and saying the famous words. And the networks had to film the wall and rebroadcast that. Super grainy black and white when Michael Collins was using a high def, you know, color camera inside to take the fake shots of the Earth in the portal window. So they had color cameras on hand. But of course, they're terrified of getting caught. So they want to create the most grainy crap on planet Earth. The Hasselblad shots that are in Life magazine, right? And every magazine on planet Earth at the time. They were also released inside a collector's edition sort of memorabilia to certain members of the Air Force. Bart Sybil's father was in the was an engineer, I think. And he got a copy of these things, and Bart just used to sit and look at them forever. As a child, he believed everything, of course. But in those books, they actually have two different shades of black. So once they get over the astronaut's head, it's a whole different black. Because they wanted to erase any artifacts of wires or something structural in the background. Later, of course, those have all been digitally mastered and cleaned up so that you will never find that material. If this never gets truly revealed, then they win. And no one will ever see the other catalog unless someone's buried in a basement. And they'll probably blame the printer for having an issue, right? Well, they probably just ran out of black and had to use a different black for that second half of the photograph, because that's the way that works. But all the Hasselblad shots took a while to come back. Now, they've already been designed for a year, right? They take them on that set in 68, maybe even had a second session someplace else to really get those shots down. No one in the spacesuits are the astronauts. It wasn't Buzz Aldrin. It wasn't Neil Armstrong in those suits, hence the gold blast shield in front to hide their face. And so they don't take chances if they don't have to take chances. Richard Nixon making the phone call to the moon. No delays. Unbelievable. You know, I ran into a guy who was probably in his 30s at a smoke lounge, my other smoke lounge, and this guy just got livid with me about the phone call having delays. And he was claiming to have knowledge. He was one of these complete weird geeks that was trying to say that he was super deep in the government. And he kept saying, well, I'm a part of this organization. I said, well, that's great. What does that organization do? And I don't give a fuck what organization you're part of. Tell me what you know about telecommunications and switches and how that technology would have worked and what broadcast systems would have had to have existed to broadcast a fucking audio signal from the surface of the moon to something that's going to receive it on Earth and beam it to the White House, and then he's got to talk and back and forth, so there's no delay. He just got angry. He went through the typical first stage of Kubler-Ross, and he just stuck there. He was drunk, too, a little bit. But I think it's really strange. There's this weird thing about the Mother Goose Syndrome, which is the sort of genetic benefit of those that tell lies at the government level. If you are a person that worships your government, you really think that they just tell the truth all the time, especially intelligence agencies, there's something wrong at home. There's something severely wrong and missing at home. The Mother Goose never really imprinted themselves on you, somehow. And so it's a thing that will replace that parental figure for you. It's the thing that never lies because your parents lied. It's the thing that pays attention to you and cares about you in your mind because your parents never cared about you and paid attention to you. What's interesting is that the people that decipher it out oftentimes have great childhoods and great parents, and they're able to continue thinking for themselves because their parents encouraged that behavior, because the household was relaxed. Remember what I told you in a couple episodes back? When you're not worried about money, you think more clearly about money. When you're worried about money, you don't think clearly about it at all, and you'll spend it unwisely. But your whole life is that way. You know, when your brain isn't under trauma, you have very clear thoughts, and you have the time to think about a problem from multiple angles. So the more successful you are, doesn't mean money, but the more successful you are with your brain, the more you have the opportunity to look at things from different angles. You know, I just rewatched part of my Kubrick episode, and you know, he's a big chess player. From childhood, he was making money selling photographs to Look magazine and playing chess in parks in New York. And we know that smart people play chess, and we know that he was smart. But the interesting thing about it is, to be good at chess means that you have to be able to hold in your mind several moves that could happen. And the reaction that you're going to have, and the reaction after that, and the reaction after that. So seeing a move is not just, I could use my pawn, I could use my knight, I could use my bishop. It's three or four or five moves out if you do use that character. And then you have to look at all of their responses that could possibly happen. So one move from you is going to equal 20 moves that could happen just to think five moves out. You understand? So when you have an individual like that, they can see things immediately from a lot of different angles. And they could be very left-brained, non-creative. Just so happened Kubrick was using photography to develop his right brain and chess to develop his left brain, and therefore he could see it. Now, the conspiracy, of course, that Kubrick, you know, was blackmailed into this thing. I'll just repeat what I've been saying for years. The entire family had identical passports because the entire family always traveled together. All the time, by boat, not by plane. And no one has any passports in America in July of 1968. They were already back home. Daddy was already working on Clockwork Orange, trying to figure out which project to greenlight and how he was going to do it, because, you know, it took a while to set up the locations, the cast, and that guy was utterly meticulous about that. Did he figure it out because he's a director and he looks at all the horrible shots that are happening? Probably. Does he give you a little bit of a signal inside of The Shining? Maybe. But the sweater in The Shining was an absolute mistake by the Italian woman that knitted it. Her boyfriend told her, look, because she was like, what do American kids want? I got to make a sweater from scratch. So there's no copyright problems with whatever the kid's wearing. And the boyfriend said, in front of Stanley's daughter, they just went to the moon, do something space-oriented. Poof, the sweater exists. The carpet is not the shape of the launch pad, so forget that to begin with. But the art director, after one of the daughters, Vivian, she went to England, and, or sorry, went to London to get a bunch of gaudy-looking carpets, which was her directive given to her by her father. She brings back all these patterns. He doesn't like any of them. The art director got Hicks's carpet, put it in there. There's no association at all with launch pad. Now, it might be a cute way to do a little launch pad looking thing, but there's no direct association with it. After that, you know, room 237, there's a lot of people that were on the set when Stanley was notified that the number from the book, which I think was 217, they came to him and said, hey, man, they don't want you to use that number because the hotel in Colorado has that same room. And he was totally annoyed and just said, well, just change the number. Like, why are you contacting me about something so stupid? I don't care what number's on the fucking door. Just change it. And so that was not a huge strategic thing. There's lots of witnesses to that moment. Everybody's standing on set while he's being interrupted. Plus the art people that came up to him and said, we got to build the door, the production designer people. And there's a problem. Wasn't a huge conspiracy. I know it's super awesome to believe that that's what he was doing. The rewrite of the ending of the book. I don't want to ruin the movie for you, but, you know, a person gets really hurt that we all love. And that was construed as someone may have passed away in his circles. The only thing I could say is that because 2001 had NASA people on it, plus Doug Trumbull, which I would assume Trumbull would be involved with whatever they did in New Mexico, Never heard anyone say that, but Trumbull was able to do a lot of powerful things after that movie, and especially after the 1969 to 1972 era. He's the guy. I mean, if you really needed the effects, he's the dude that's going to figure out a lot of it. But the intelligence agencies are the top one in America. Its number one job is counterfeit money. So knowing how they create plates for $100 bills using negatives and cutting them up with razor blades and then pushing them together and re-photographing them, that's something that they already natively knew. So faking the photographs using that technique where they got a bunch of the crosshairs that are on the filter inside the Hasselblad cut off because they screwed up, you know, it's not a big stretch. I think that Stanley Kubrick is just a target because of 2001. And I think that is a catalyst and an incubation. Kissinger using the moon set to direct some shots, as admitted by his wife, was it Catherine? That's believable, all right? I mean, that's a little bit of evidence that seems real, right? It's like it's not him. It's this other agency that comes into England and rents the set, and then finally he ends up going down and helping them shoot whatever the hell they're trying to shoot. But if you see the set in 2001, especially the moon set inside the soundstage, it's a matte painting around a pit of wood. So it's a pit they've dug into the, supposedly, you know, they dug it down into the surface of the moon. It's like a giant Olympic swimming pool indentation in the surface of the moon. The surface of the moon that they actually built in the movie doesn't look anything like anything you've ever seen associated with the moon missions. They didn't build a moon surface and then go take shots. Those were all matte paintings, photographed, and then Trumbull did his magic. But there's two guys in the world that are very enigmatic, and they are and were utter geniuses, and that's Stanley Kubrick, and I would add to that bunch Rod Serling. Rod Serling lived a very public life after Twilight Zone, just visiting, you know, scripts like Planet of the Apes to write the last act, the Statue of Liberty. Genius. And then Stanley Kubrick, who's just, if you understand film and you understand storytelling, I understand the allure to say, man, if there was anybody who could do this, he's an above ground asset that we could pin this on that makes sense to us. To not pin him on that, you have to then go back to probably what's the truth. And that is that, unfortunately, frustratingly so, you'll never know the people that were the geniuses that created this hoax in the first place. And that's okay. Don't let it bother you. Now, what's interesting about the Saturn V and everything else is that you actually have proof that the Saturn V rocket was built multiple times and launched multiple times and never had any issues, at least to my recollection. And so that is a real thing. What it was actually able to accomplish in terms of leaving Earth's orbit and all that stuff, well, that's just a fairy tale they tell you. You know, the slingshot theory that could not possibly work, because when you want to use slingshot to exit, you would have to constantly add thrust every time it goes around to increase its orbital ellipsis to gain that momentum to then slingshot out. You can't just go around the Earth exactly the same shape of the Earth, perfectly circular. You don't get a slingshot that way. You have to increase it, increase it, increase it to get out, and that's just not part of the platform. All those boosters were gone very quickly after launch, and the only thing you have is the little booster on the service module in theory to get yourself out of Earth orbit over to the moon, which is obviously ludicrous, right? But any of you that used to watch those, the 70s especially, a little bit in the early 80s, in Christmas time, they had these claymation, you know, Santa Claus, Frosty the Snowman, and Rudolph little animations that we used to watch, and they were brilliant, man. You know, this little sled would go through sort of some, I don't know what the surfaces thing was, but you have little sled marks behind it and that kind of thing. And you watch those and they're so elaborate, all the inside sets of the rooms and the characters and them flying in the sky. And that is exactly the same paradigm of thinking that you should maintain for everything that you saw regarding the service module existing with a lunar module and then making it to the moon, landing, coming back up, reattaching, push the astronauts through, get rid of the lunar module top, and then flying all the way back home, and then parachuting down and shape of a bullet that supposedly came butt first down. That'll never happen. It just will never happen. Caltech has proved that in big machine computer supercomputers, and they said, man, it will always tumble and kill the astronauts inside. There's just no way it works that way. So when we start talking about the proofs and the smoking guns outside of the launch of the Saturn V, what's really funny is that what we're really doing is we're talking about trying to prove that the Santa Claus claymation stuff isn't real, and you got people on the other, well, that looked like Randy Rudolph, man. His nose looked like, it's all bright, and that's how the song says he is, And Santa Claus looks fat, and he's got that mustache and that beard, man. It looks real to me. So that's sort of the lunacy of us having the conversation after that point. In terms of the capsule coming down the ocean, well, you just fly a jet really high and push the thing out the back and pop the parachutes, which could have never fit in the cone of that thing in the first place. That's easy. It does get more tangible, of course, when they start faking the footage on the moon, and then they do it 6 times. And of course, Apollo 13 stuck in the middle to create a little bit of drama. Even if you believe that rockets work in space, it won't help you solve the problem that all of the maneuvers that brought the lunar module from behind the service module, again, they're stacked up head to toe. But when it comes around with nobody in it, okay, that this thing comes around and attaches, because the service module has to stay in its orientation. It can't turn around and grab it and then turn back. It can't do it. But they barely describe this to you. It's sort of the blackout in the video where they say, and then magic happens, right? So this thing has to come around. I've never really seen anyone other than a cartoon try to explain to you how this maneuver worked. But it comes around and then attaches. And of course, the astronauts go through. Theoretically, now they're in the lunar module, two of them. It drops down to the surface of the moon. And the moon is hauling ass underneath this animation, right? They have created a giant globe of the moon as a prop, which they accidentally took pictures of it and filmed it. It actually has a train track that goes around, which is the dolly track that goes around the surface of this thing. Because they showed you, like, hidden in plain sight, they showed you the props they created to create this hoax in the first place. Isn't that just amazing? That you're staring right at the how they did it. But you're not supposed to put two and two together. And if you do, just simply call a spade, then you're the jerk and you're the one that's delusional. So you've got this lunar module dropping, and the surface is going by crazy fast because they're not in geocentric orbit. If they were in geocentric orbit, if that's the way they're going to explain how this lunar module top part comes up and perfectly kisses the service module, which that would be like, again, throwing a needle across the room to go through the eye of another needle that someone else is shaking over here, It's just that the absurdity of accuracy should just be dawning on you. Oh my God, right? I mean, like, seriously, 3D space, and this thing is just randomly on the surface of the moon, and then it goes, I'm going to go back up and attach to the service module, and the service module is just right there, poof, and it completely is going all the same speed. When they proved by observation that the bottom was going really, really fast, I mean, the surface of the moon was going super quick. Because had they gotten into geocentric orbit with the moon, which usually takes a much higher orbit, it wouldn't have had to have a 10,000-pound thrust engine. It just would have been able to go straight down, and the surface of the moon is going the same speed as the lunar lander. It would have just went ting, just like a guy in a canopy parachute just putting his toe down and pulling the wires. It would have been a straight drop down perfectly. But that wasn't the case. That's not even how they theorized it to work. And yet we have to explain this to people. Isn't that funny? So that little phase, okay, I want you to remember this phase. The phase of after the Saturn V supposedly launched everything into orbit, the service module turns on its little engine in the back, and it's just going to slingshot out to the moon. But it's also got enough fuel to come back. That's the other funny thing. All of that's a black box of complete lunacy. The mathematics and the odds of that are absolutely, utterly insane. And anyone who believes that, they believe a whole lot of other crap that's not true. Guarantee it. Their whole brain is full of disinfo and denial. But they probably don't have any recognition that they're in denial. They just believe things that are absolutely physically impossible. So this whole thing gets over there, and it's really the black box doesn't stop of craziness until they claim that the lunar module magically hits the surface of the moon. At that point, we start another chapter. So chapter one is legit chapter that the Saturn V can get off of a launch pad and out of your sight. That starts chapter two, the fiction of it going around and slingshotting without adding any extra boost to create an elliptical slingshot, right? It somehow magically goes to the moon. Does all this maneuvering of the lunar module coming off the bottom of the surface module, rotating, attaching, guys going through, breaking off, going down. Surface of the moon's hauling ass, but somehow they could just magically land on that, right? So the third chapter is all of the photography of them supposedly on the surface of the moon. The splash act one is Neil Armstrong coming down the ladder saying his little phrase. The rest of the acts in that particular chapter are all their claims of putting up a flag that's just flapping in the wind because they're blowing intense air conditioning at these actors in these suits because they are boiling inside the hangar with extensive lights on them. They're just boiling in these things. Now, these are suits that need to be oxygenated, right? So it's got a little capsule. Go look up the anatomy of the backpack of any one of the moon suits, and you have something like basically a large coffee thermos is providing all the oxygen for all the missions, was never re-engineered, never made any bigger. And I think they spent 25 man hours on the moon breathing, two guys, by Apollo 17. Right. Then go look up scuba gear. And go look up the two tank scuba gear. Go look up, in fact, just call a scuba diving company. Just do yourself a favor and say, man, I got a question with the two biggest tanks that I can take down to swim in the ocean, in a stable ocean. How much time could I get from two gigantic tanks on my back? And when you hear that, if you are a trained breather and you have no events occurring like sharks or something that freaks you out that makes you breathe heavy, you can get almost, I think it's 4 hours from two giant tanks. But this tank's the size of a thermos. Right. Well, then these are the other problem that may or may not even be factually true, but NASA hatched this theory that when you're in the sun on the moon, because there's no atmosphere to protect you, the number I've heard is as high as 280 degrees Fahrenheit. I have heard it quoted as low as 250 degrees Fahrenheit, but I don't care either way you fix it. That's within 70 degrees of light and a match, 250. But then if your shadow side is exposed to your suit, it's negative, that exact figure. So if you settle on 250 Fahrenheit in the positive, it's negative 250 in the negative. If you want to have the number I've heard several times, which is 280, it's 280 negative. So imagine your body having 280 degrees on its chest and then negative 280 on the back. How are you able to live? Your gloves, the gloves that they had, right? Well, they're just made of like rubber ceramic. Their fingertips are right there. They're less than a quarter of an inch insulation of rubber so you could feel what you're doing, you know? And they're not dying. Insanity. Insanity. Just the vehicle itself being on the surface of the moon. Yeah, they put some insulation on it. That, you know, the lunar module looks utterly ridiculous when you really look at it. I mean, it's the biggest pile of crap you've ever seen in your life. It's like they waited too long to make it, and then they had to make it hastily. I mean, kudos. People believed it, right? Just put some shiny foil down below, and it's like, oh, that's real. But that capsule would have so many structural issues. The Hasselblad camera, of which I grew up with, and so did Vivian Kubrick, because we both had fathers who were into photography, they take a year to make because they're so precise. It's like a Swiss watch, you know, of like a Piaget Polo watch. It takes a year to make these things. They're big. The negative's a 120 negative. It's huge. The shutter is one of the most delicate parts of the camera. I saw an interview that I can't find anymore where they interviewed the guy that made the cameras that went to the moon. The guy. And again, you'd have to commission this camera ahead of time, because even if they were to speed it up 2x, it still takes 6 months to build the camera. They said they put a special lubricant inside the camera to make it work in these horrible temperatures. But they asked the guy in the interview, what if the camera swayed from 280 Fahrenheit positive to 280 Fahrenheit negative? And the guy literally had like a stunned look on his face. Several beats go by in the script where he's just speechless. And he said something to the effect of, well, it would explode. It was obvious that whoever commissioned these cameras from Hasselblad, the I don't even know what you call it, the craftsman that made it, was never told about that issue, because his face was like, what the hell are you talking about? And it was almost as if he realized, I'm making this up, but it looked like he had just realized he had heard that before and never applied that to the design of what he was doing. Now, I've talked to Vivian, and she said, look, man, I've used to carry around Hasselblads all the time, and when we used to film in really hostile temperatures, these cameras would lock up like crazy. You'd had to wrap them and wrap them and wrap them just to survive a normal winter storm on planet Earth, right? We had shutters on my dad's Hasselblads freeze up numerous times. It's part of the body. The back has the film in it, so you can push in this aluminum. It's almost like the cut the lead in half thing. You put this aluminum shield in there that protects the shutter and the inside of the camera. Then you wind up the film so none of it's exposed, and then you pull the back off, put a new back on, pull the sleeve out, and you're ready to go. And then I was the monkey in the background swapping out the film as a kid in several weddings and other events. I've seen these things jam with almost no environmental problems whatsoever. I never took a Hasselblad out in the winter. I don't think my dad would ever even consider such an idea. Unless it's out there and you poof and you make a couple shots and you run back inside. These cameras are in the most extreme conditions of any device in history. Plus, we always seem to forget the fact that the cameras were basically bolted to the chest of Neil Armstrong. Well, Hasselblads are cameras that you have to look down into, like a Mamiya. You look straight down this huge viewfinder. It's a 120 viewfinder. And you pop this thing. It makes that sound, that clocky sound, right? It's crazy. You've heard it in movies, I'm sure. And then you wind it until it stops winding, because you pull the next negative around. Plop. Plop. Now, there's about 30 shots, about 27 shots that came back from the moon. All of them amazing. Someone recently, I'd say the last 10 years, tried to suggest they took dozens and dozens of film, and they try to create some crappy shots. And it's like, my God, you know, coming up with that evidence 50 years after the fact, super simple. Just take some weird shots and say those were done on the moon, and that's what Neil did. Now, this dude's taking the most incredible composite shots on planet Earth. I mean, amazing. The lighting, the composition, the exposure, it's all utterly perfect. Never a crappy shot, because they were selling you something. All right. It's just a hoax, man. You know? Eventually, they take the shot of the lunar module's top part popping off and blowing out a bunch of, you know, debris, and it goes straight up. And the camera follows it up. A lot of people, I've said this before, a lot of people have a problem with the notion they could mechanically create some sort of tripod that would you know, tip up. Because they're like, well, who was moving the tripod? I actually do believe that they could. I don't know that I obviously, I do think a human being probably did do it in the hoax. But if you really had to in 69, I think you could pull that one off. Think about all the props that were in sci-fi movies, you know, controlling a little motor that goes up. But the idea is that they got it perfectly set up. So I don't know if they could actually calculate the lack of resistance and the amount of velocity going up in a zero atmosphere surface of our moon. So it is very hokey that this thing was actually offered as a true accomplishment through some automated circuit. But again, you've got proof that by the time they were handing the lunar module down to the surface of the moon, the kickstand part stays there and the top goes up, right? That somehow it's just going to absolutely marry the service module. You have to, if you know any pilots that talk about why don't planes run into each other more in the sky, you always get the same sort of answer. Well, there's a lot of space up there, man. And if you think it's big in the sky of the world, imagine outer space on the surface of the moon. It's big. It's big. And trying to get two objects to marry each other up there, and they just never had a problem doing it. First time was a charm, you know? Again, remember, it took 165 attempts to get the 747 to take off from the ground. So they'd push it down the end of the runway, and there just wasn't enough lift in the wings. And so they had to do 165 times after we had 50 years of aviation before that. But NASA, unbelievable. They sold us this brand that suggests that they have the smartest people in the entire world, which may indeed be the case, but somehow they're now devoid of any errors. Mm-hmm. Sure. So that ends chapter 3, and we get into chapter 4. Chapter 4 is very quiet. They just essentially say they got a little bit of the footage, right? So it's coming up, maneuvering around, and then all of a sudden the astronauts come through the seal. Seals don't work in space. Let's just be clear about that. And they come in, and then they close. They get rid of that little piece, and then the service module coming around the other side of the moon sees Earth and just goes, man, it's time to leave. And the ethereal gravity of the moon doesn't have any play in this, apparently, and they just zip straight back to Earth, no problem. Having spent a bunch of fuel to get to the moon in the first place, they still have a whole tank to get home. And then you have this bullet-shaped thing that breaks off from the service module. Well, they don't really explain that. They say it happens, but they don't explain the fact that you've got a in pretty much a vacuum. You got a situation where, I don't know if you've seen these Final Destination videos. They're horrific, where you've got a big rig, and the big rig has a bunch of I-beams behind it. This has happened several times in history, but unfortunately, I saw it once just at a stoplight. A guy hits the brakes to hit the stoplight, and the beams in the back aren't secured properly, and the beams go through the cabin and kill the guy. Okay. It's so quick, and it's almost like there's no gruesomeness to it. It's just over, just instantaneously, because that stuff behind you ain't going to stop just because you're stopping the front of the cabin. So you're going to have to break off that capsule with some sort of force, some sort of explosion. And you're going to have to get that thing behind you away from you so it doesn't hit you as you're trying to go into this return orbit thing, right? And of course, they made it sound very delicate, right? They said, oh my gosh, the if they went in too steep of an angle, it would burn up. And if they went too shallow, it would bounce off the surface, bounce off the atmosphere of Earth. Bounce off? I mean, really? I don't buy that for anything. A rock out there is going to come down no matter what. It might just take days as opposed to a few hours, right? But it has these three parachutes. They're about the size of your house, each one of them. And they're supposedly packed to the density of bark in the top part of that capsule. Now imagine, we have airbags today. Airbags have a powder in them that ignites. So the part of your steering wheel gets blasted off, or the side of your, you know, doors and stuff blasts up. And this powder is exploding in all of the onion layers of this bag in your car, excuse me, and it's blasting out in your face, breaks your nose half the time. You definitely have usually skin rashes and things, the burn marks from it because it's so fast. But, you know, being dead and having a rash, no problem. But I don't know if that technology existed. They certainly don't claim it. So how do you get three parachutes packed in there, even with a theory that they said packed to the density of tree bark, to pop out and inflate before this thing crashes in the ground? We're just going to overlook the fact that Caltech has proven that a bullet-shaped object will always invert to its point. For us kids that grew up with guns, once you have a spent round or you've got the tip of a bullet that hasn't been attached to some sort of cartridge, you can throw it and it's amazing. It always seems to flip around, but eventually the nose hits the sidewalk every single time. And when you look at the impact of the copper head or the lead head, it's always got it right on the point. That's just nature. Path of least resistance. Let's overlook the fact that this was the issue. But now you got this romantic capsule coming down with three giant parachutes making a splash. It has the actors, Michael Collins, Buzz Aldrin, and Neil Armstrong in the first one. Now, at this point, they know that they have been involved in the biggest hoax in world history. And you might be able to cite some other hoax that happened in the past. But the big thing about this particular hoax is it's been televised. It's been recorded. If they ever get caught, the problem is that everyone can watch it over and over and over again. Look at that. Look at that. Look at that. Fake, fake, fake. These scumbags. And these guys were worried that they were going to get busted. They do a press conference. It's the famous press conference where they look, at least initially in the press conference, they look so utterly nervous. Neil looks unhealthy. Neil looks like, quite frankly, your best friend who cried his eyes out when his girlfriend broke up with him. Neil was a God-fearing man. Michael was a little more calm. And Buzz was definitely just kind of drawn on the surface of the desk next to him, right? Now, there comes a point in this particular chapter where a lot of people really are pissed at the astronauts. I have... I changed the script from sort of going down Bart Sibrel's initial impression where he really was angry at the astronauts. You know, he almost got Buzz Aldrin to admit on camera. In fact, he kind of was admitting on camera that they didn't go. And astronauts gone wild. I don't want to blame the astronauts because we just, you know, your whole family gets liquidated. Look at Gus Grissom. They killed that guy and his two buddies. They flooded their suits with cyanide. I do have a correction, though. I didn't realize that they had actually reversed the door. So the door opened in and not out, which is utterly insane. But that was part of the conspiracy, was that in all interior design, there are rules about where doors open. When you have a super confined space, you know, doors will open out instead of in, that sort of thing. But this was a ridiculous notion. This door would have ever opened in. Still should have been able to do it, but these guys were already dead. And they're trying to do it in a painless manner so they can live with themselves. And then a switch was replaced in the console the day before. Gus was home telling his wife, hey man, these intelligence guys are all over the launch pad. And the next day he dies. And so his wife remembers these things. The report on what actually took place apparently is about 11 inches thick of 8x10 paper. And in that report is the cyanide admission, but you're not allowed to see that report. But Bart met with his wife and child, who's now a commercial pilot, I believe. And they said, yeah, it's in here. You know, so we just have to live with it. What are we going to do? So the force being applied by these agencies is absolute. I mean, it is. You know, what are you going to do? I think that we're at a point when we have to consider, oh, wow, you know, is admitting this kind of stuff in a video going to get us in trouble? Maybe, I don't know. But the idea is, I don't think this is something they're concerned about. They do calculations every day on every conspiracy and how much you believe it or not. And, you know, if tens of millions of people actually are coming on board because of a single source of information, then that source might get nailed. Because of their algorithmic censorship, they're kind of doing us a favor in that they keep our spread to an almost dismally small infection. And the thing that they can't calculate is how much you tell your friends these kind of things. I mean, sure, they can listen to your phone and all that good stuff, but they don't really know the adaptation unless they can get both sides of the conversation and then monitor sort of, you know, Joe talked to Bill and all of a sudden Bill's cell phone starts blowing up and his computer starts blowing up with rabbit hole search algorithms, right? But you have to understand too, the people that we are basically battling against, they believe they've got everything dead to rights globally at this point. They're not worried about the past. They're not worried about September 2001. They're not worried about it. None of that being exposed is going to stop what they think they have perpetually in motion today. So they don't care. It's just for us a mechanism to get our brains to see things in a more lucid light, in my opinion. What I am encouraged by is the comments that say, dude, you need to get back on this subject. And these are from very intelligent people that know that nothing new has really occurred. They know. They're just like, keep it alive. Keep it alive. You know, I want to hear about it. I can listen to you repeat this stuff over and over and over again. And plus, there's new people. And I want to stop and just say thank you for watching all the videos over the years. I mean, it's really encouraging. You know, YouTube has pretty much got everything figured out. They figured out how to screw a channel over. It's almost magical how unbelievably capable they are of keeping the views down and unsubscribing you. And you don't know because they know out of, say, 5,000 people. The thing is, 5,000 people subscribe to your channel. We have 5,378 today. It was like 82 the other day. If I published a video and every video got 5,378 views, that means everyone who subscribed is still monitoring the channel and watching the videos. Well, that's obviously not the case. In a good video, I get 1,000 views, which is only 20%, below 20%, to be honest, right? So that's pretty good retention. You know, it happens for everybody. But what they've just figured out, and it's algorithmically provable at this point, and there's nothing you can really do about it because this is a private service. They don't have to show your shit. They don't have to let you on their service for any reason whatsoever. Censoring me after I get on, that's a different argument, but just saying, hey, you know, we just don't think your stuff should be promoted, you know. So they have control over their orifices, right? And because they have the system loaded for themselves and you can't create your own easily, you can't create your own video viewing service with any level of success. Rumble's the best competitor at this point. They just laugh all the way to their next disinformation situation, right? Now, I want to report, and then we'll get back to some of this subject matter. Brighteon was something that was started a long time ago. A mutual friend of mine, I'm 2 degrees from the founder. What I wanted them to do was just open up the channel and go, look, for you, you can bring your whole channel on and then, you know, we'll give you some, you have to have a certain number of views in order to get your next batch, but they wouldn't let me do that. And so I put 50 videos up there and just let them sit there forever. I didn't, you know, whatever. And I came back and I got another 50. And so instead of putting up chronological videos, I just put up some of my most popular videos up there, and we're almost at our next allocation, which I have no idea if that'll be 50 or 100. So if you like Brighteon, there's a lot of stuff going up there, sort of the cream of the crop, top picks that I think would be more digestible for a lot of folks. BitChute continues to do really, really well. Very slow crawl. It is sort of phenomenal how the other platforms don't have subscriptions that are consistent. It's crazy. It's like people watch videos and the concept of subscribing is not a thing at other platforms, even Rumble. They just don't care. They're like, I'll find you. You know, don't worry about it. Now, as far as, you know, other moon activity, you know, there's this whole line of crap that they're going to go back. And, you know, the other one is that the 17 guy, real or not, said that we did actually go there, but we went with a different mission and different technology. I have a new take on how that could be true without being what we may literally have been asking, which is that being there and being there are two different things. Putting a man up there, that's the ultimate accomplishment, if the surface is even capable of having that happen. The other one is putting an object up there that could record something and having that be non-disclosed to the public because it's using some technology that they're not willing to say. Or in revealing that tiny accomplishment, you're going to reveal that you never went in the first place. So it could be that they put something on the surface, and then even if they didn't get any reconnaissance information back or anything, they just know they sent an object at that thing in space and then it landed on it, whether it be 3,500 miles up or 237,000 miles up, doesn't matter. They got something to stick on it, you know? So that's a potential way that that particular answer could be true, because I have an episode that basically said, did 17 lie? Except I used the letter back in the day. And for the one thing I get a lot from, if anyone says anything kind of intelligent after sharing some of this stuff, is that they'll say, well, what about the photographs we have of the lunar module's kickstand on the surface of the moon, plus the moon rover, you know, tracks that are up there? Remember that when very astute people asked NASA, what is the dimension of a single pixel in one of these pictures? And then they factored that into the kickstand. They realized that the kickstand's like 25 feet across now. So that hoax of actually taking a photograph of the surface of the moon has been debunked, because it would have been so tiny in that photograph that it would have looked like a speck. And you definitely wouldn't have been able to see any moon rover. So the idea that they constantly lie and don't care about the facts, it's wonderful. It's like a little... It's like, hey, stupid people, we took a picture of the surface of the moon. Here's the kickstand and the moon rovers. And hey, smart people, it's fucking bullshit, you know, whatever, right? It's like, it's great that they essentially go, well, okay, for the smart people, no, we didn't go, whatever. They'll figure it out instantaneously. But everyone else is dumb, which is 98% of the world in this particular subject. They go unbelieving, rah-rah, super-duper, right? Now, if we ever say that we're going back, the real question will be, for me, what is the platform they're going to suggest again? Are they going to try to copy the Saturn V service module, lunar module? Are they going to create new versions, new upgraded sci-fi looking versions of that? How are they going to say that they're dropping a manned aircraft down to the surface of the moon? Today, anything that they claim today is going to have to be utterly documented. Unlike the Mars missions that SpaceX says they're doing and NASA JPL says they're doing, it's still all like mystery science until they start taking these photographs at a set somewhere. It's all mystery science. Like, you don't get it explained to you. Oh, yeah, they'll do little interviews here and there about payload weights and thruster engines and stuff. But it's all anecdotal, sort of high-level, 60,000-foot views of the actual science behind it. And if you were to ask an intelligent, of course, they always hire these absolute buffoons to do the interviews, so you never have the intellectual depth to ask the question. But you're not able to take statistics and you know, thrust ratios and payload weights and put it in a physics model, in a video game engine perhaps, and actually do the calculations, have it do it for you. The video game engines are amazing. I mean, you just tell it what the gravity of Mars is and a capsule. And technically speaking, they should have atmospheric density as well and be able to simulate the whole thing going, well, this is going to crash because it's just going to come wandering off into space. But today, okay, we do have an amazing pool of technology to draw from to assert that we do have a platform that could land a man on the moon. You're going to have to believe the rockets can talk to a vacuum and actually cause and affect the thing. You're going to have to believe that they can slingshot a vehicle away from Earth without adding thrust every single time it does an orbit. Remember that. I mean, all the slingshot landing diagrams that you see in all of the reconnaissance satellites that are supposed to be going to Mars and Jupiter, they show you dozens of loops that keep getting tighter and tighter and tighter. But the thing is that the speed's going up and up and up the more tight it gets. You've seen how, and Cornell University once released a video with two physicists that said, we think we have a way to at least achieve faster than light travel. And they were talking about vortex mathematics, which is not complicated, okay? You've all done vortex mathematics in a tub of water when you were a little kid. You pull the drain on that water, starts creating a little tornado at the end of the drain, and there's a little speck of something in the bathtub, and it's on the surface of the water, and as it's going around the outside, it's just going so slow, it's no problem. You could read the newspaper if it was a newspaper, right? But once it gets into the vortex, it starts closing the loop, it's going fast as shit, and it's like, it's a blur, and then boom, it's down the drain, it's gone, if you're lucky. That's how a slingshot would work. And it makes sense to go away from something with an extra speed, but landing on something? And that's why they always say it crashes into the surface, right? But using that to slow down? Hilarious, right? But the amount of simulation we've got of where the moon is and how fast it's traveling, how fast it's rotating, apparently. Again, you got to use all their claims to have a discussion about this. So if you're yelling at the screen, amen, that's all bullshit. I'm with you, but we got to just entertain their mathematics in order to defeat them inside their mathematics, right? But they would have to have something escape Earth, in my opinion, and literally be traveling at the perfect pace. That's when they arrive at the moon, and if they could lock into orbit around it, it's essentially in a geocentric orbit. So as it's turning at the cigar, was the unit, it was the vehicle of some sort. It's actually traveling the same speed as the surface, and that way you could drop something down. It could land without any problem, roughly, and then it could come back up and rendezvous with the thing, and there wouldn't be any catching up or anything, and then it could just hit its boosters and leave. Theoretically, right? But the other one is to start endorsing different types of engines that actually talk to the fabric of the universe. You know, engines that are electromagnetic, that talk to the ethereal dust that it makes everything that you know that's physical. That's how I think they're doing it if they've ever done anything, right? And I'm just going to keep repeating this because it's an amazing story. I have a friend of mine, first degree, who if you say to him, we didn't go to the moon, he will go into a baby liberal fit. That you're an asshole, don't be that guy. It's everything to him that we went. Okay. This man is a special effects genius, okay? But he's in Area 51 filming Top Gun when they launched a vehicle off of a runway down at the end while he was there. He saw the employees going around the corner of a hangar, and so he's like, oh, what's going on? So he and another guy walk around the corner and see what it looked like, as I've had it described to me. I didn't have him tell me this, but our best bud between us, saucer-shaped vehicle turns basically white hot and goes poof up into the sky and is gone instantaneously. Maybe a frame or two of travel, but it's gone. And everybody on the tarmac jumping up and down, screaming, hooray, essentially. And he's wondering, am I going to live to the end of the day because I saw something I wasn't supposed to see, apparently. So that's a real story, man. That's just like, I mean, at this point, 2 degrees. The actual story can't even be 2 degrees away, right? So a guy that doesn't believe any conspiracy saw this and passed it on. Take it for what you will. It changes how you see things. Is there someone inside that vehicle? Hell if I know. Obviously, if there's not a human being inside, then its travel is of no worry because it can have amazing G-forces on it. But I will tell you that I don't know of any silver, like before this thing lit up and took off, I don't know of any metal we could assemble on Earth, an alloy, some strange metal that could handle that shift in speed change to the point where it's going. I mean, it seems like if it were to vanish out of the horizon eye and disappear into the sky in a vertical lift, okay? I don't know how fast that is. I mean, that seems like it didn't break any sound barriers. That's the other thing. So it's definitely going faster than the speed of sound, for sure. And there's no boom, 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 boom as it goes out. Okay. So something has been created that we have knowledge of that we could use. Again, getting out of the vehicle that's probably doesn't have any doors necessarily that aren't just absolutely fitted on. I think that would be, you know, you still have to breathe. You still have to survive the environment. You still have to be able to survive all the radiation. You know, we skip radiation in this redo, but, you know, you've got radiation that'll kill astronauts that are just 450 miles up, let alone hundreds of thousands of miles up. The normal ambient radiation from the sun is so deadly that by 1988, NASA figured out they're going to have to insulate a capsule with 6 inches of water just so the occupants inside won't die. And that's before Van Allen, and that's before a coronal mass ejection. Well, now you get out of the vehicle on the surface of the moon with no atmosphere, you're getting utterly bombarded by that exact radiation, which needs to be protected by water. Okay, the film would develop itself, you know. It does. All these factors factor into the utter absurdity of everything, right? So if they're going to go back, how are they going to do that? With man? What outfit? Just think of any of the most incredible technology you could possibly conceive of, whereby you could create a window portal so the eyes can see. Even a camera LCD system, which is going to sense light on the outside and just project it on an LED screen on the inside. You're fully encapsulated. How are you going to use your hands? How are you going to use your fingers? Your fingers are very close together, little phalangi, right? How are you going to insulate the hands if you don't have a giant mitten? Are they going to have those little gripper, you know, claws that they use to pick up trash on the side of the highway just to do anything? Can you do enough when you get there to even make it worth the trip? How much is this whole thing going to cost? They're not going to introduce a new power source anytime soon, unless we take back the world. And if we do, we have to be very careful about how it's distributed, because power always equals a population increase, and we already have issues. And I'm not talking about being overpopulated. I'm talking about we have, 70% of the world living in some horrible situation that they want to leave their country for. I mean, they don't really want to leave their country, but they're leaving because they can't survive their government. There's a country that's trying to fix that in the world with a new currency. We'll see what happens with that. And then, you know, if this is exposed at any point, let's just say, let's do a little simulation. I got about an inch left on this stick. You know what I love to do? You and I are part of a think tank. We're in a conference room. This conference room is full of the best of the best from your country, my country, the most honest to goodness people ever. All races, all creeds. And we're like, okay, we have got to inform the world that these organizations that have participated in space travel in every major country have compounded their lies, starting with probably Russia, technically, because they were there first. Hours later, the United States. The United States takes it to a whole new high. If you haven't seen my episode, NASA for Sale, you should go see that to have this conversation even deeper. But NASA started selling it, right? Sold it to China, sold it to Israel, sold it to India. So all these countries can claim all these things and feel good about themselves. Okay, I get the reason why they did this. But we have now need to unravel these organizations that employ hundreds of thousands of people around the world. These people are going to be displaced. And what do we do with them? They were working in a corrupt organization. And we have to figure it out. It's like a Nuremberg kind of thing, right? Except only a few people actually hurt people. And those people may not even be physically alive anymore. So we don't want to punish people for what other people did. You have kids who are coming out of colleges, astrophysics degrees and what have you, and they're coming in to these organizations believing everything, so they're not guilty of anything. It's really only the heads of state that would be the ones to greenlight more and more of the hoax. But then we have to factor in, well, were they being manipulated themselves? Or did they willingly go in there? It may be impossible to tell. So, there may not be any need for any grave punishment, because we can't prove anything. Maybe we could, you know, but I mean, if someone just says, a guy walked up to me and said he's going to kill my whole family, he didn't write me a letter, right? He didn't send me an email or a text message. That's what he said. You kind of have to take it at face value. So instead of going for the big retribution of jail time and that kind of thing, unlike the 2020 medical staff that utterly kill people, or I should say 2021, with protocols and bullshit science, this group of people will just simply have to be scarlet lettered, depending on their height in the organization. We literally cut blank checks to the kids and the younger people and the people that are so distant from the management that they just simply didn't know. And it would be kind of a fun little war story they could tell. Yeah, you know, I work for Nestle when the whole thing came unglued, you know, and it's like, I didn't know. And, you know, what's good about it is I had a plastics degree and I learned a bunch of stuff while I was there. And so, you know, I spun off into one of those other organizations. But you're going to have to take the heads of state. And I don't know where it comes down to because I have no idea how these organizations are set up. But you're going to have to say those people and above aren't allowed to get government jobs, government funding. They need to be scarlet lettered hard enough that the background check is instantaneous. Yes, your employee that you're or that candidate for your job is willing to lie and deceive the American public, your country's public to steal money. They're willing to overlook deaths and threats and all this other stuff. So they're not to be employed, at least in that category. And quite frankly, what job can they take after signing the dotted line with the devil? What job do they deserve after that? They're a threat to society, period. Maybe you don't need to put them in jail because you can't prove all the ins and outs, but maybe there's a problem with them. You also don't want to hurt your country. You know, one of the things we can all agree on typically is, were there any benefits to this hoax in the first place? I can emphatically tell you, yes, 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 yes. People thought we went. So a lot of people got into aerospace, physics, computer programming. Hell, even 2001 got people into AI because of the HAL 9000 character. Okay. That increased the overall IQ of a lot of folks that even though the public education system tanked in the 70s and really was realized in the 90s, right, where kids aren't even really graduating academically on paper, but they're getting their degrees and walking out like it is today. Those of us, probably like you and me, we were able to find the books and study and just disregard any of the BS, and we were able to test what we're talking about. So, hey, if I wrote a program that worked, it worked. If I built a circuit that works, it works. You can't tell me it doesn't work that way. I made it work that way. So, there's a lot of benefits. Feeling like you're civilized will actually fake it till you make it a lot of times. A lot of countries that would be otherwise regressed advance themselves because they tell themselves a little story. All right. I'm pretty sure we're on the same page with this. All that's important is that tomorrow is corrected. That tomorrow is no longer a day full of people suffering globally because there's containers full of people moving around the world. Unknown to people. Kids being born into this world without birth certificates so they could be moved around the world without any trace. Happens every day. Happened today. Probably happened while we're having this conversation. Seems like it's not the most, this conversation isn't the most important one, but it's a means to an end. It's a means to waking up an individual to that reality. It's important. It's an important process. It's a process, right? I would say to you this, if this is important and you have a better source than my videos, then please turn me on to those videos. If you think my videos are valuable and you think this is an important subject, refer the videos off. Post them on your social media. Send them to people in text messages. You know, every video's got a share button. Whatever venue you like, Rumble, BitChute, YouTube, Brighteon, was it Odyssey? Another one? Odyssey just pulls them all over, man. Odyssey's amazing. They got every video I've ever done. Beautiful website, fast streaming. It's incredible. The unsung other outlet that doesn't seem to police anything. We want to stimulate this conversation. If you haven't been to deepthoughtsradio.com, that might be another way to start everyone off. Remember, there's a top picks up there now. I've done a little bit of cleanup up there. If you find any videos without the audio, let me know. If you find any videos with the audio without the video, let me know. Because YouTube took a bunch of stuff down, and I think I moved everything over to Rumble, but I'll miss one from time to time. But we have all the video, all the audio, social media links, and again, you'll think you'll be proud of which ones we're linking to and which ones are not. I actually was linking one that was gone. It was brand new tube. It's gone. I mean, I've had my whole channel on services that just vanish overnight, you know, and it's mind-blowing the amount of work that just gets erased overnight. You know, it's crazy. But we have a store with a bunch of fun shirts up there that will help you stimulate this conversation. Again, I'm going to be changing stores here. I don't make any money from those shirts, and I mean nothing, because they have crushed the cost of the shirt. Like, shirts are like $22 before I get to put a penny on top of the shirt. So I put a couple bucks on some of them. I think maybe a hoodie, I still make some money. But I'll be putting some new ones up there as well. I am working on season 7's intro. It'll probably come out about the end of the year, unless something I can fudge something together. But to the Patreon, PayPal folks, thank you so much. Remember, when you come on to Patreon, you get the audio the second it drops. You'll also get periodicals about sort of what's going on in my life, so you can kind of figure out what's coming up next or why it's taking so long to make something. It's just basically all the metadata between the episodes. But anyway, I want to say thank you for all the views. We have 1.2 million views. We're actually technically at 1.25 million views. We have 86 years viewed just on YouTube. Imagine if you add it all together, all of the podcast listening minutes, we're probably well into about 150 years worth of content being consumed. Meaning if a child was born and we take everyone's listen minutes, they'd be 86 years old today. Pretty darn cool. We have 4.7 average on the Apple iTunes podcast, which is cool. What's beautiful about it is they don't censor anything, because they don't hold the videos. They don't hold the audio files on their side. They just stream down. But thank you for everyone who went up there and gave me a thumbs up on the reviews. You can get it on Google. I think you can even get it on Amazon's podcast too. So I'm not doing Spotify because you have to pay for that. Anything they want to charge me a monthly charge for, I'm not doing it. But I did move all the audio files to another server. So every time you download the podcast now, it should be lickety-split fast. It was always pretty quick, but GoDaddy lies about all of their contracts. They say you have so much storage, but they don't want you to use it. So, you know, those guys. Anyway, take care of yourself and someone else, and I'll see you in the next Deep Thoughts. Over and out.